So, if you will, please, if you will go back with me to 1934, we're going to assume that this is July 25th, 1934. Of course, we're making the assumption that they had PowerPoint computers back then. Of course, they didn't. But just ignore that part of it. And we have with us this evening an airmail pilot. Now, this airmail pilot is currently flying for Eastern Air Transport out of Candler Field in Atlanta, Georgia. And he is flying the Curtis Condor. He's been flying the airmail route since the early 20s, from the very beginning. And I'd like for you, if you would, please, to welcome with me Mr. Brian Carley. Brian? Okay, good evening, Brian.
Good evening.
I'd like to welcome you to the Theater in the Woods here this evening in 1934.
Thank you.
And I'd like for you to tell us just a little bit about yourself, if you would, please. Where are you from, and when were you born, and so forth?
I was born in a small town outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, on June 15th, 1896.
Well, how'd you become an airmail pilot?
Well, kind of in a roundabout way. When I was a child and approaching high school, my father thought it would be a very good idea for me to learn a trade. So he decided that I was going to be a blacksmith.
I see.
So he set up an apprenticeship for me at a local blacksmith shop, so I learned how to shoe horses and fix wagon wheels and things of that nature. But while I was there, you know, school was always interesting to me, so I graduated high school, and I was actually taking some college courses, which to me was, I'm pretty proud of that. But what happened is when I was a blacksmith and going to college, there was a war in Europe going on.
Absolutely.
And being young, 19, 20 years old, I was pretty interested in this. But our country, well, they just decided that neutrality was the way for them. So nothing really happened. Time went on. And, of course, with the sinking of the Lusitania and some other odds and ends, we did end up getting into the war. So myself and all my peers and my friends, boy, we were excited. We were going to go over there and we were going to lick the Kaiser ourselves. We were going to win the war single-handedly. So when they started the draft, my friends and I, we all went down to the recruiter there and said, hey, we want to go over there.
Absolutely.
And they said, well, what would you like to do in the Army? And, well, I'd had enough of shoeing horses, so I wasn't interested in the cavalry. And I thought, well, maybe artillery would be, I would use your head, it'd be kind of interesting. But I saw on a piece of paper that they were looking for aviation cadets. That's the thing to me. So I signed my name on the dotted line, and I was now an aviation cadet in the U.S. Army.
I see. So you learned how to fly in the Army, then?
I did. I was sent down to Texas. I was sent to Kelly Field in San Antonio, Texas.
Kelly Field, that's a really an interesting place. A lot of Jennies there, I suppose.
There were. But actually,
what was your training like during that period of time that you went that you were there,
well,
at Kelly Field?
When I first got there, the United States was woefully unprepared for the war that they had just gotten into. The military is very small. So I got down there thinking, oh, this is great, I'm going to start flying airplanes. But really, for the first six months, all I did was build barracks and mess halls and things of that nature. But eventually the Jennies came, and I was assigned a civilian instructor because the military didn't have any instructors either. So after 3.5 hours of duel in the Jenny, my instructor hopped out, and I went off by myself.
3.5 hours. That's it. That's all.
I was a little behind, actually.
You were a little bit slow.
Huh? I was. But back then, you flew in the morning because it was calm weather. You flew in the evenings generally. And like, for example, the first time we went up, my instructor showed me how to do some turns and climbs, and we landed. And then the next day, we started into takeoff and landings, and we just kept doing them until I figured it out. And that's how it went.
A lot of accents, I would assume.
But luckily we had lots of Jennies. There were several crashes a day. Most of them were survivable, but occasionally some of my peers got killed.
Well, after your training finished, what did you do at that time?
I was ready to go over and be a pursuit pilot.
I was going
to grab a hold of a Newport and shoot down every airplane I saw with an iron cross.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, World War I ended.
It did. It did.
What did you do after that, then?
Well, the CO said, hey, you know, Brian, would you like to stay in the military? And I said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, we have a position in the quartermaster's corps for you. And after you've flown, it doesn't seem too exciting.
Right.
So I got out, and I went back home, and I thought, well, you know what, maybe I'm just designed to be a blacksmith. That's an honorable trade, and I thought I'd go home and do that.
So that's a picture of you on the left there, I believe.
Yes,
that's what I thought.
That was me. I went back to blacksmithing, and I did that for a little while, but quite frankly, I just missed flying. I mean, it was in your blood. It's just something that you do.
So did you try to get another airplane or anything, or did you...
What I did was I had kind of got my mustering out pay all at once,
right.
I had been sending money home to my mother and father, and instead of spending it, they saved it for me, so I had a nice nest egg, and I heard that they were selling some surplus Jennies, and I knew how to fly one of those. So
why not?
So I took a train down to Baltimore, where there was a surplus Jenny dealer, and I bought a Jenny.
You bought a Jenny. Well, what did you do with it?
Well, I flew it home. I didn't know really what I was going to do with it, but I just knew I wanted to keep flying. So I flew the airplane back to just outside of Harrisburg there, and when I landed, all my friends came for rides, and then they told their friends, and I thought, well, hey, wait a minute. I bet I could, maybe start charging for rides.
Here, absolutely.
And I did. So I kind of gave rides there in my hometown for a while, but then everybody kind of got used to me being there. So I said, well, maybe I should go try the next town down the road. And I tried, maybe go down to Reading or Lancaster or Myerstown, things of that nature. So I did, and I kept going and going and going.
So you were just barnstorming.
Yeah, I was trying to make a living with an airplane.
Trying to make a living,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So what about this? So how do we get involved with the airmail part
of
it?
Well, what happened was I was out barnstorming, and quite frankly, I wasn't making as much money as I thought I would.
Yeah, that happens.
Well, for example, I made it to Williamsport, Pennsylvania one time, and I landed, and I was getting $5 per person per ride.
That's not bad.
No, it wasn't bad. So I took up 12 people that day. So I had $60. Man, I was wealthy.
Yeah.
But the problem is, in the last landing, it was dusk. It was similar like this, and I was just trying to sneak one more passenger in, and I didn't see the tree stump, and I wiped out the landing gear of the Jenny.
Not good.
I made $60, but it cost me $200 to repair the airplane. Needless to say, I was worried about getting any skinnier than I already am by not being able to eat. So I happened to land in Sunbury, Pennsylvania one day. I was flying around. I thought, oh, there's a beautiful field there. It was level and flat, and the grass was cut. I thought, what a great place to take some rides. So I landed in Sunbury, and I noticed the people in the town didn't come out and see me. And I asked the farmer what was going on, and he says, well, people are used to airplanes. This is an airmail, emergency airmail field.
Oh.
So I hung around for a while, and sure enough, one of the airmail planes dropped in, and I was talking to the airmail pilot, and he was telling me about his job, and he was making $2,400 a month flying the airmail.
$2,400?
Yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah, I mean,
back when, like, a Model T, what could you buy a Model T for?
Yeah, I think a Model T was going for around $200 at that time.
Say, that was
so
great.
Here I was.
Yeah.
I was what, $140 in debt for my landing gear.
Yeah,
and here he was making $2,400. So
sounds inviting, doesn't it?
I want to do that. So
absolutely.
I asked him, I said, how do you get a job as an airmail pilot? And we got talking for a while, and he realized, I guess, I was okay. And he says, well, what you need to do is you need to go down to the airmail office in College Park, Maryland, and talk to a gentleman by the name of D.B. Collier.
So you did?
I did.
Well, how'd it go?
Well, I got the job. But en route, I was flying, trying to fly. I figured I'd fly the Jenny down to D.C. I didn't have a car. I didn't have any other way to get there. Right at the Maryland-Pennsylvania border, the old OX-5 quit, and I landed in a cornfield and flipped upside down, and I ended up selling the Jenny for about $140, which I owed to fix the landing gear, and I ended up taking the train to Washington, D.C. When I got down to D.C., I met Mr. Collier, and this airmail pilot already put in a good word for me, so I was hired.
So you got the job.
I did. I got the job as an airmail pilot.
Well, where was your first airmail run then? Where did you go?
Well, there was a need for pilots in New York at the time. What had happened was, remember, the original airmail routes were from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
to Philadelphia,
right.
to New York.
Right.
And once they got that up and running, they wanted to expand out west. So they were going to go from New York now to Chicago. And so I was actually, it was good timing because they needed pilots, so I was hired for the New York to Chicago run.
I see.
And they sent me up to Hadley Field in New York.
Well, what was your first flight like? What kind of airplane did you fly? And just tell us a little bit about it.
It was kind of scary, actually.
I bet it was.
I'd been flying for a while, and I thought I was a decent pilot. But I showed up at Hadley Field, and I met the station manager there. And he says, well, you're right on time. We got you scheduled to fly out there. And the way we did it back then is the airplanes didn't have the range to go all the way to Chicago. So we'd stop in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, and we'd stop in Bryan, Ohio, and then Chicago, and we'd set up a shuttle like that. So he walks me over to the hangar, and there's a De Havilland DH-4, which was, we used those in the military, but I didn't get to fly those. Those were bigger and better than I had flown. So I never flew one before, but what was I going to do? Say no?
Airplanes and airplanes.
No. Right? So he gave me a map, and he said, okay, here's where you are. Here's where you're going to go. The nail's in the front spit, you know, full of gas. Have at it. So thankfully, the weather was good. And I was somewhat familiar with central Pennsylvania, so I kind of knew my way. And I found my way to Bellefonte all by myself.
Well, I'm sure in that area, the weather wasn't always good. So what did you do when the weather wasn't good?
No, the weather wasn't good a lot of times. We went.
Regardless.
We had to go. Yeah. I mean, the mail had to get through.
Yeah.
And what we would do is, I eventually learned by talking to the other AeroMile pilots, is on your map, you would take notes. And for example, like when you're leaving Bellefonte and you're going to go to Cleveland, you take off out of Bellefonte and you head for the first split in the ridge there at Bald Mountain. And once you hit that split, you take a 310 heading for a while until you pick up the western spur of the railroad.
Oh, uh-huh.
And then follow that.
Follow that.
But you better climb to 2,200 feet or you're not going to clear the ridge. And then you hold that heading as the railroad veers off. You hold that heading until you see Clearfield. And you know Clearfield has three little lakes down like that. So you really want to get familiar with the route because very often if, let's say the weather was 500 feet overcast, well, you were at 400 feet. And if it was at 400 feet, you were at 300 feet. And sometimes you were right above the trees. Mail had to get through, didn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
The fellow by the name of Slim Lewis, didn't he tell us a little bit about him, didn't he? Have a claim to fame.
Well, Slim was a character, and Slim used to brag that he could fly lower than anybody
than
else.
Else.
And when the weather was bad, Slim would make it through.
Yeah.
So he was in the hangar there, and we had mechanics there and fuel and things like that. And old Slim was bragging that he flew lower than everybody else. And the mechanics kind of got tired of hearing this. So one of the mechanics, he snuck out back, and he broke a tree branch off of a local tree, and he stuffed it in the landing gear. And he said, hey, Slim, you must have been flying pretty low. And they let him in on the joke later, but he got the point that he was bragging a little bit too much for everyone.
Well, Brian, I'm sure while you were flying all that area that once in a while, probably many, many times, you would fly into a cloud. What'd you do? How'd you fly the airplane?
Well, we didn't want to fly into the clouds. We avoided the clouds like the plague. I mean, you can't see. At the time, you know, we couldn't tell. If you're in a cloud, are you turning? Are you climbing?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? So we avoided the cloud as much as we can. But some pilots, you know, they decided, yes, rather than being down low and going around trees and telegraph poles, if you know your destination is clear, why not go up above?
Sure.
Okay, and
sure.
Then you'll just fly over it.
So you had to go through the clouds to get up above.
If you had to, you had to. If not, you know, you picked your way up and then let down. But if you did get stuck up on top, what we did is a technique, and it was something you learned to do. You learned to not trust yourself is what you did. You would lock your feet on the rudder bar. I mean, you cannot move it, and you cannot. You may swear you're turning, but you can't. Mm-hmm. And then you put your fingers on the control stick. You don't grab it. You put your fingers on it. And all we had was we have an airspeed indicator, we had a compass, and an altimeter. So you put your fingers on it, and you'd watch your airspeed indicator. And if the airspeed would go up, you'd pull back a little bit. If it would go down,
just a little bit.
Now, if things got completely haywire, what you did is you close the throttle, you put the stick back in the corner, full rudder, and you enter a spin.
Fun.
And you hope that when you broke out of the clouds, you had enough room to get out of the spin.
Yeah.
You put the airplane in a known condition because what to expect.
Yeah, you knew what to do.
You only had to do that once, and it would scare you. But
I'm sure a few times it didn't work out for some people.
For some people, yes. Yeah, that is correct, yes. Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the airports that, that you've gone in and out of. The first one that comes to my mind is Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. What was that like?
Yes. Bellefonte was a wonderful place. It was right in the middle of the Alleghenies, and Bellefonte. Max Miller picked Bellefonte as one of our stops. Max was one of the first AeroMile pilots hired, and he was directed to find all the nice fields between New York and Chicago, and he did a great job. Well, he liked Bellefonte for a couple of reasons. Number one, the farmer's field was great and it drained well. But second of all, when he got there, he was welcomed with open arms. The mayor came out, the civic leaders got together, and they actually built a hangar for us.
Oh, really?
And boy, when the airmail came to town, we were celebrities.
We were somebody.
We really were. And being young and single, it was a great place.
That was great.
We all used to stay at the Brockerhoff Hotel.
I've heard of that hotel
before. Yes, a wonderful, beautiful hotel. And believe me, lots of times you were in there and someone would pick up your tab and, hey, thanks for bringing the airmail
just
in.
Yeah, because you're an airman. Boy, and, what a life. Huh?
But some of the guys really got carried away. As a matter of fact, Slim Lewis one time, he would always buzz the hotel. And one time he buzzed the hotel so low that his prop wash spun the weather vane on the top of
really?
It. Yeah. Another guy, Ernie Allison, he'd bring his dirty laundry in a bag on his lap and he'd fly over the hotel and he'd drop it out. And he was good. He could drop that thing right on the front steps of the Brockerhoff Hotel. So by the time he got to the airmail field, tied to plane
clean clothes,
he came back, his clothes were all clean. So we were celebrities. We were treated wonderfully there, and it was just a great place.
Like a beautiful hotel.
Yes,
absolutely.
Very nice hotel.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.